A sloth, a donkey, and a curious human send a prompt and see what they're doing. One hits a record with a question on his mind. Two brothers pick it up, see what they find. Corn takes his time, Herman's got the facts. Back and forth, they never hold back. My weird prompts, come on in, that's where we begin. My weird prompts, glad you're here.
This episode was generated using artificial intelligence. Please verify facts.
Daniel sent us this one. He's coming off a low-dose sleep medication after a year and a half, which is one of those things where you think it'll be a couple weeks, and then suddenly it's 18 months later. But his real question goes deeper than tapering. He's describing what a lot of people with ADHD live with, this airplane trajectory where takeoff and landing are the hard parts, and cruising is fine. And he's asking, if someone genuinely needs pharmacological help with circadian rhythm, what are the emerging therapies that actually target the melatonin system in a more sophisticated way than the blunt instruments we've had for decades?
This is where the science has moved fast. The older drugs, the Z drugs like Ambien, the sedating antihistamines, the low-dose antipsychotics like Seroquel, they're essentially chemical couches. They force sedation, but they don't engage with the circadian machinery. You're not sleeping because your body clock says it's time to sleep. You're sleeping because a molecule is switching off the wakefulness circuitry.
That's the distinction Daniel's drawing, right? Sedation versus actual sleep architecture. We've talked before about how Seroquel at low doses is basically a very expensive antihistamine with some extra serotonin receptor baggage.
At 5 to 25 milligrams, quetiapine's primary action is histamine H1 receptor antagonism. Same mechanism as Benadryl. It's not doing anything sophisticated for sleep architecture. And the morning grogginess Daniel mentions? That's the predictable hangover from histamine blockade. Your brain's histamine system is one of the main drivers of wakefulness, and you've still got the drug sitting on those receptors when your alarm goes off.
Let's start with the actual problem before we get to the solutions. Daniel mentions ADHD and circadian rhythm. Is there something structurally different about the ADHD brain's clock? Or is this just correlation?
There's substantial evidence now that delayed sleep phase syndrome is disproportionately prevalent in ADHD. Some studies put it at 70 to 80% of adults with ADHD reporting clinically significant circadian delay. And it's not just behavioral. There's genetic overlap between clock genes and ADHD risk genes. A big study out of the Netherlands found that polymorphisms in the clock and PELOK and PER3 genes were associated with both ADHD diagnosis and evening chronotype. The melatonin onset in people with ADHD is often delayed by an hour or more compared to neurotypical controls.
It's not just, I stayed up scrolling. The signal itself arrives late.
Dim light melatonin onset, DLMO, the standard marker, is measurably shifted later. And here's the thing that gets missed. The ADHD brain also often shows a blunted melatonin amplitude. It's not just timing. The signal is weaker too. So you've got a weaker signal arriving at the wrong time, and then you're trying to override that with a drug that just hits you over the head with sedation. No wonder people feel terrible in the morning.
Which brings us to the actual question. What's the smarter approach? Daniel specifically mentioned melatonin receptor agonists, and I think he said agonists or antagonists, which is interesting because both directions are being explored. Walk me through this class.
The melatonin system has two main receptor subtypes, MT1 and MT2. MT1 is primarily involved in sleep onset. It suppresses neuronal firing in the suprachiasmatic nucleus, the brain's master clock. MT2 is more involved in circadian phase shifting. It actually resets the clock's timing. The older drugs and supplements mostly flood both receptors indiscriminately. The newer drugs are trying to be much more selective.
The over-the-counter melatonin everyone's tried. That's the least selective version imaginable.
It's a mess. A study tested 30 commercial melatonin supplements and found the actual dose ranged from 83% less to 478% more than what was on the label. Some also contain serotonin, a different neurotransmitter entirely. So when someone says melatonin didn't work for me, part of the issue is they may not have been taking what they thought they were taking.
Even with a pure preparation, the pharmacokinetics are terrible, right? Melatonin has a half-life of something like 40 minutes?
30 to 50 minutes. You get a spike, and then it's gone. That's not how endogenous melatonin works. It rises gradually over hours and stays elevated through the night. So the first real innovation was prolonged release melatonin, prescription in many countries. Circadin was the brand name, a 2 mg prolonged release formulation that mimics the endogenous profile better. But it's still just melatonin. It's not doing anything you couldn't theoretically do with a natural hormone.
What's the next step up? Daniel's asking about the novel stuff.
The one that's gotten the most attention is Remeltion, brand name Roserum. FDA approved in 2005, so it's not brand new, but it's been underappreciated. Remeltion is a selective melatonin receptor agonist. It hits MT1 and MT2 with high affinity, about 3 to 16 times higher than melatonin itself, and it has a longer half-life of about 1 to 2.6 hours. But the key difference, unlike Z-drugs or benzodiazepines, Remeltion has zero activity at GABA receptors. It's not a sedative in the traditional sense at all.
It's not forcing anything. It's more like turning up the volume on the body's own sleep signal.
Here's the clinical significance. Remeltion has shown zero abuse potential. It's not a scheduled substance. There's no withdrawal syndrome. For someone like Daniel, who's been on a medication with a rough discontinuation profile, that's meaningful.
What about efficacy? Because the knock on these gentler drugs is always that they don't actually work when you need them to.
The data is modest but real. The pivotal trials showed Remeltion reduced latency to persistent sleep by about 13 to 14 minutes compared to placebo. That's not dramatic, but it's consistent and it doesn't diminish over time, which is a problem with the Z drugs. Tolerance builds with Ambien, it doesn't seem to with Remeltion, and importantly, there's no next day cognitive impairment. For someone who struggles with morning grogginess already, that matters.
13 minutes doesn't sound like much, but if you're lying there every night for an hour, it's the difference between functional and miserable.
The effect is larger in people with actual circadian disruption rather than just generic insomnia. These drugs aren't for everyone. They're for the subset whose problem is specifically circadian misalignment. Daniel's airplane takeoff and landing. Description is basically a textbook description of delayed sleep phase.
Remeltion has been around for 20 years. What's come after it?
Tasimeltion, brand name Hetlioz, approved in 2014. Initially for a very specific indication, non-24-hour sleep-wake disorder in blind people. If you have no light perception, your circadian clock runs on its own intrinsic period, which in humans averages about 24.2 hours. Every day you drift a little later relative to the solar day. Over weeks, your sleep cycle completely decouples from day and night. Tasimeltion acts as a circadian resynchronizer. It provides a pharmacological time cue that replaces the absent light signal.
It's a synthetic Zeitgeber, a manufactured time giver.
And that's the conceptual breakthrough. These drugs aren't hypnotics, they're chronobiotics. They're not putting you to sleep, they're telling your master clock what time it is. Tasimeltion is a dual MT1 and MT2 agonist like Remeltion, but with even higher selectivity and a longer half-life.
It's since been approved for broader indications, right? I remember something about Smith-Magenis syndrome.
Smith-Magenis is a rare genetic disorder where the circadian rhythm is essentially inverted. Melatonin peaks during the day instead of at night. In 2020, Tasimeltion got approval for that, and more recently, it's been studied in delayed sleep phase disorder and even jet lag. The jet lag data is interesting. A single dose can shift the circadian phase by about 2 to 3 hours.
That's what Daniel's really asking about, I think. Not just help me fall asleep, but help my clock actually match the world I live in. So if someone has ADHD-related delayed sleep phase, is Tasimeltion more appropriate than Remeltion?
It depends on the specific misalignment. Remeltion is better characterized as a sleep onset facilitator. It helps you fall asleep at your intended bedtime, but it's a relatively weak phase shifter. Tasimeltion is a more potent phase shifter. If your entire circadian cycle is shifted 3 hours later, natural melatonin onset at midnight instead of 9 p.m., Tasimeltion might actually pull that forward. Remeltion probably won't move the clock much. It'll just help you sleep once you do go to bed.
One is more like a nudge at bedtime, and the other is more like resetting the clock itself.
That's the distinction. And this is where clinical nuance matters, because a lot of doctors still just write insomnia and reach for whatever they've been prescribing for 20 years. The actual question should be, is this a sleep onset problem, a sleep maintenance problem, a circadian phase problem, or some combination? The treatment differs.
We've got Remeltion and Tasimeltion. What's in the pipeline?
a couple of interesting directions. One is the orexin antagonists, which I know Daniel mentioned melatonin receptor drugs, but the orexin system is so mechanistically elegant it's worth touching on. Orexin is a neuropeptide that promotes wakefulness. The dual orexin receptor antagonists, suvorexant, lemborexant, and daridorexant, they don't force sleep, they just turn down the wakefulness signal. It's a completely different mechanism from GABA drugs. They've shown clean efficacy with minimal next-day effects.
The melatonin receptor antagonists, Daniel mentioned? Because that seems counterintuitive. Why would you block melatonin receptors to help with sleep?
That's for a completely different application. Melatonin receptor antagonists are being explored for depression, particularly the sort where people feel leaden and sleep excessively. The idea is that in some mood disorders, the melatonin signal might be pathologically strong or mistimed, contributing to anergia and hypersomnia. Agomelatine is used in Europe and Australia. It's actually an MT1 and MT2 agonist, which is confusing, but it's also a serotonin 5-HT2C antagonist, thought to increase dopamine and norepinephrine in the prefrontal cortex. So it's an antidepressant that also resynchronizes circadian rhythm. It's not approved in the US. Liver toxicity concerns. The European Medicines Agency requires liver function monitoring, and the FDA has been more conservative. But agomelatine is fascinating because it's one of the few antidepressants that doesn't cause sexual dysfunction or weight gain, and its sleep effects are restorative rather than sedating. It increases slow-wave sleep.
For someone with ADHD, who also has that delayed circadian rhythm and maybe some mood symptoms, because those things travel together, agomelatine could theoretically hit multiple targets at once.
But the liver monitoring is a real barrier, and it's not available in the US. More practically, the most interesting emerging approach for ADHD-related circadian disruption is low-dose melatonin agonists combined with properly timed light therapy. The drugs can shift the clock, but light is still the most potent zeitgeber we have. Morning bright light exposure, 10,000 lux for 30 minutes, can advance the circadian phase by an hour or more over a few weeks. Combined with a melatonin agonist in the evening, you're pushing the clock from both directions.
That's the kind of thing where the medication isn't a standalone fix, it's part of a protocol. And I think that's what Daniel was getting at. Not what pill do I take forever, but what does a smarter approach look like?
The protocol approach matters because the circadian system is stubborn. You can't just take a pill at 10 p.m. and expect your clock to suddenly shift. The suprachiasmatic nucleus has been entrained to a particular phase for years or decades. It takes consistent, correctly timed interventions over weeks to shift it meaningfully.
Let's talk about pediatric implications, since you were a pediatrician. ADHD and sleep problems in kids, is this the same mechanism? And do these drugs have a role there?
The delayed sleep phase is definitely present in kids with ADHD, and it's often more pronounced because children naturally have a later chronotype during adolescence anyway. So you've got an ADHD-related delay on top of a developmental delay. The challenge is that most melatonin receptor agonists haven't been extensively studied in pediatric populations. Prolonged-release melatonin is more commonly used in kids, especially in Europe, but the evidence base is thinner than I'd like.
Pediatricians are mostly relying on behavioral interventions and maybe low-dose melatonin.
Sleep hygiene, yes. The problem is that sleep hygiene advice, no screens before bed, consistent bedtime, cool dark room, that's all good, but it doesn't address an underlying circadian phase delay. If your melatonin onset is at 11 p.m., putting a kid to bed at 8 p.m. is just setting them up for frustration. They're not going to sleep because their brain isn't ready. That's where the chronobiotic approach is underutilized. You might want to use a tiny dose of melatonin, like 300 micrograms, not the 3 to 5 milligrams you see in supplements, at 7 p.m. to gradually pull the circadian phase earlier.
300 micrograms versus 5 milligrams is an order of magnitude difference.
The dose response curve for melatonin phase shifting is not linear. The phase shifting effect plateaus at relatively low doses. Higher doses just give you more of a direct soporific effect and more next-day grogginess. A lot of people take too much melatonin and end up feeling hungover, which is exactly what they were trying to avoid.
The supplement industry has essentially trained people to overdose on melatonin.
The optimal phase shifting dose is probably between 300 micrograms and 1 milligram. The typical supplement is 3 to 10 milligrams. people are taking 10 to 30 times the optimal dose and wondering why they feel terrible the next day.
Which brings us back to the prescription agonists. The advantage there is precision. You know exactly what you're getting. The receptor selectivity is defined, and the pharmacokinetics are predictable.
That's the core of Daniel's question. He's been on a medication that's imprecise, probably quetiapine or something similar based on the grogginess complaint, and he's asking what the precise tools look like. The melatonin agonists are precise. They do one thing. They don't touch GABA. They don't touch histamine. They don't touch dopamine. They just engage the melatonin receptors and let the endogenous sleep system do its job.
There's a trade-off, right? The precision means they're not going to knock you out if you're anxious or overstimulated. If your sleep problem is hyperarousal, not circadian misalignment, these drugs might not feel like they're doing anything.
That's an excellent point. And this is why phenotyping matters. If someone's lying awake because their brain is racing, ruminating, worrying, planning, that's a hyperarousal problem. Melatonin agonists won't touch that. You might need something that addresses the cognitive arousal directly. That's where cognitive behavioral therapy for insomnia, or CBTI, is actually the first-line treatment, not medication. The drugs are for the circadian component specifically.
How do you tell the difference? If someone's listening and thinking, I don't know if my problem is circadian or hyperarousal, what's the giveaway?
The simplest clinical heuristic, if you're tired but can't sleep, that's probably hyperarousal. If you're not tired until much later than you'd like, alert and awake at 11 p.m. and then get sleepy at 2 a.m., that's more likely circadian. The tired but wired state is classic hyperarousal. The I'm a night owl and I can't seem to change it is more circadian.
Daniel's description, trouble with takeoff and trouble with landing. That sounds like it could be both. The morning difficulty getting going is one thing, and the nighttime difficulty winding down is another.
They're probably related. ADHD involves dysregulation of the dopaminergic and noradrenergic systems, which are involved in both arousal and attention. The same dysregulation that makes it hard to initiate focus in the morning can make it hard to disengage focus at night. The brain doesn't have good on-off switches. It's more like a dimmer switch that's sticky at both ends.
What's the practical takeaway for someone in Daniel's position? You've tapered off the blunt instrument. You're trying to figure out a sustainable long-term approach. What does the conversation with the doctor look like?
I'd frame it around three questions. One, is there evidence of a circadian phase delay? That can be assessed with a sleep diary, actigraphy, or ideally a dim light melatonin onset test, though that's not widely available outside specialist centers. 2. Is there a hyperarousal component that needs behavioral treatment? And 3. If medication is indicated, what's the most mechanistically targeted option?
The options, practically speaking, are what? Walk me through the decision tree.
If the primary problem is circadian phase delay, and I suspect for Daniel it might be, given the ADHD connection, then a melatonin agonist is the most elegant pharmacological option. Remeltion if the main need is help initiating sleep at a desired bedtime. Tasimeltion if the phase delay is severe and you actually need to shift the clock. Low-dose prolonged-release melatonin, 1 to 2 milligrams, is a reasonable over-the-counter alternative, with the caveats about supplement quality we discussed.
If there's a hyperarousal component,
then CBT. I should be part of the plan regardless. But pharmacologically, the orexin antagonists are interesting here because they quiet the wakefulness drive without being directly sedating. Daridorexant, approved in 2022, has a relatively short half-life of about 8 hours, so it clears by morning. It doesn't have the same abuse potential as the Z drugs. It's been studied in patients with insomnia and comorbid ADHD, though the data is still limited.
What about the combination? Could you use a melatonin agonist for the circadian piece and an orexin antagonist for the hyperarousal piece?
Theoretically, yes, and there are clinicians doing this, but we don't have robust clinical trial data on the combination. The mechanisms are complementary. One enhances the sleep signal, the other dampens the wakefulness signal. They're working on different systems. But anytime you combine drugs, you're in less charted territory.
For the morning side of Daniel's problem, the takeoff difficulty, is there a pharmacological angle there?
The morning problem in ADHD is often related to sleep inertia, the grogginess upon waking. Sleep inertia is worse when you wake up during slow wave sleep, which can happen if your circadian rhythm is misaligned with your wake time. So fixing the circadian alignment should reduce sleep inertia. But there's also a specific approach being studied, low-dose stimulants taken before waking. There's a drug called Jornay PM, which is methylphenidate formulated to be taken at bedtime but delayed release, so it kicks in 8 to 10 hours later. The idea is you wake up with the medication already active. For someone with ADHD who struggles with morning initiation, that's a clever approach.
It's not a sleep drug. It's a wake-up drug taken at night.
And it's FDA approved for ADHD in children and adults. The clinical trial showed significant improvement in early morning functioning, but it's a stimulant, so it's not for everyone, and it doesn't address the circadian problem directly. It's more of a workaround.
Which is fine, right? Not everything has to fix the root cause. Sometimes you just need to function.
The goal isn't some idealized, perfect sleep architecture. The goal is being able to live your life. If a delayed-release stimulant gets Daniel through the morning, and a melatonin agonist helps him wind down at night, that's a perfectly reasonable protocol, even if it's not addressing some deep circadian root cause.
Let's go back to the emerging therapies, because Daniel specifically asked what's promising. What's in phase 2 or phase 3 trials right now that's novel?
There's a drug called ACH-0029, an oral selective MT1 receptor agonist. By being highly selective for MT1 over MT2, you get the sleep-promoting effect without the phase-shifting effect. That could be useful for people who want help falling asleep but don't want their circadian clock messed with. It's in phase 2 trials. Conversely, there's work on selective MT2 agonists that would shift the clock without causing drowsiness, potentially useful for jet lag or shift work. Neither is on the market yet, but the receptor subtype selective approach is the direction the field is moving.
What about delivery systems? Is anyone working on more sophisticated ways to deliver melatonin or its analogs?
There are transdermal patches in development that would deliver a steady low dose throughout the night, more closely mimicking the endogenous profile, and a sublingual formulation that bypasses first-pass liver metabolism for faster onset and more predictable blood levels. But these are incremental improvements, not paradigm shifts.
I want to circle back to something you said earlier about light therapy, because I think it's probably the most underused tool in this whole space. If someone has delayed sleep phase, morning bright light is essentially a drug-free phase advancer, but nobody does it.
The compliance is terrible. You need a 10,000 lux light box, you need to sit in front of it for 30 minutes within an hour of waking, and you need to do it every day for at least 2 weeks to see a phase shift. Most people try it for 3 days, get bored, and quit, but the efficacy data is strong. A meta-analysis from 2019 found that morning bright light therapy advanced circadian phase by an average of about 1.2 hours in people with delayed sleep phase disorder. Combined with evening melatonin, the phase advance was closer to 2 hours.
For someone who naturally wants to sleep from 2 a.m. to 10 a.m., but needs to function on a 10 p.m. to 6 a.m. schedule, that combination could actually close the gap.
In many cases, yes. But it requires consistency. The circadian clock is stubborn, and it will drift back to its intrinsic phase if you stop the interventions. That's the thing about chronobiotics. They're not cures, they're ongoing management. You're constantly reinforcing the desired phase.
Which is true of a lot of psychiatric medication, too. You don't cure depression with an SSRI. You manage it.
I think that reframing is important for someone like Daniel who's been on a medication for a year and a half and is now coming off. The goal isn't necessarily to be medication-free forever. The goal is to find the least harmful, most effective long-term management strategy. For some people, that might be a melatonin agonist indefinitely, and that's fine.
What's the safety data on long-term use of Remeltion or Tazemeltion? If someone's going to be on this for years, do we know?
Remeltion has been on the market since 2005, so we have about 2 decades of post-marketing surveillance. The safety profile is remarkably clean. No significant abuse signals. No withdrawal syndrome. The main side effects are headache, somnolence, and dizziness, usually mild. There's a theoretical concern about prolactin elevation. Melatonin can stimulate prolactin release, but clinically significant hyperprolactinemia is rare. Tazemeltion has a shorter track record, but a similar safety profile.
Compared to the alternatives, the Z-drugs, the antipsychotics, the benzodiazepines, the safety advantage is substantial.
Orders of magnitude. The Z-drugs are associated with complex sleep behaviors, sleepwalking, sleep driving, sleep eating, that people don't remember and can be dangerous. The low-dose antipsychotics cause metabolic syndrome with long-term use, weight gain, diabetes, dyslipidemia. The benzodiazepines cause dependence, tolerance, and cognitive impairment. The melatonin agonists don't do any of that.
If someone's doctor is still prescribing Ambien as first line for chronic insomnia, that's not really consistent with the evidence anymore.
It's not. The American Academy of Sleep Medicine guidelines from 2021 recommend CBT-I as first line for chronic insomnia, and if medication is used, the melatonin agonists and orexin antagonist are preferred over the Z drugs for long-term use. But clinical practice lags behind guidelines. A lot of primary care doctors are still prescribing what they learned in residency 20 years ago.
Which brings us to the practical question. How does someone actually get a doctor to consider these newer options? Because if you walk in and say, I read about Tasimelteon, the doctor might just think you're drug-seeking.
The approach I'd recommend is to focus on the symptoms and the mechanism, not the specific drug. Say, I've been tracking my sleep, and I've noticed that I don't get sleepy until about 2 a.m. no matter what I do. I think I might have a circadian phase delay. I've been reading about treatments that target the melatonin system specifically for circadian rhythm disorders. Is that something we could explore? That frames it as a diagnostic question, not a drug request.
If the doctor's never heard of Remeltion,
then you might need a sleep specialist. Most primary care doctors are not going to be familiar with Tasimelteon. It's a niche drug. But Remeltion is more widely known, and the orexin antagonists are getting more common. Daridorexant has been marketed pretty heavily.
One more thing I want to ask about, because Daniel mentioned it. The newer melatonin receptor antagonists. You said they're being explored for depression. Is there any relevance to ADHD or circadian rhythm?
Not directly for circadian rhythm. The antagonists are more about modulating mood and energy, but there's an interesting indirect connection. If someone has ADHD and comorbid depression with hypersomnia, sleeping too much rather than too little, a melatonin antagonist could theoretically help with the daytime sleepiness. But that's speculative and not an approved indication. I wouldn't want anyone listening to think that's a ready-made solution.
Let's pull this together into something actionable. Someone listening has ADHD, struggles with sleep onset, has tried all the sleep hygiene stuff, and is considering medication. What's the hierarchy of options you'd suggest they discuss with their doctor?
Starting from the most targeted and lowest risk, 1, low-dose prolonged-release melatonin, 1 to 2 milligrams from a reputable manufacturer, taken 1 to 2 hours before desired bedtime. 2, if that's insufficient, Remeltion 8 milligrams, same mechanism but more reliable pharmacokinetics and receptor selectivity. 3, if the problem is primarily circadian phase delay rather than just sleep onset, consider Tasimelteon or a combination of morning bright light therapy with evening melatonin agonist. 4, if there's a significant hyperarousal component, CBT, I+, an orexin antagonist like daridorexant. 5, if morning initiation is also a problem, consider a delayed release stimulant like Jornay PM in addition to the evening sleep intervention.
The older drugs, the Z drugs, the antipsychotics, the benzodiazepines, those are what, fifth line or lower?
For chronic use, they shouldn't be on the list at all. Short-term use of a Z drug for acute situational insomnia, someone going through a crisis and needs to sleep for a few nights, that's reasonable. But for chronic management, the risk-benefit ratio is unfavorable compared to the newer options.
I think that's the core message here. The toolbox has gotten better. The old tools are still in there, but there are newer, more precise tools that most people don't know about because they're not advertised on television and the doctor might not have mentioned them.
The other message is that circadian rhythm disorders are real, biologically based conditions. They're not moral failings or poor discipline. The ADHD brain has measurable differences in clock gene expression and melatonin secretion. Treating that with medication isn't a shortcut. It's addressing a genuine physiological dysregulation.
Daniel's airplane metaphor is actually perfect for this. If your plane's landing gear is faulty, you don't just will it to work. You fix the mechanism.
We have better mechanics now than we did 20 years ago.
By the way, today's episode is powered by DeepSeek 5.4 Pro.
Good to have capable help in the script department.
Now, Hilbert's daily fun fact.
The average cumulus cloud weighs about 1.1 million pounds. That's roughly the weight of 100 elephants floating above your head.
For someone like Daniel, who's coming off a sleep medication and trying to figure out the long-term plan, the first practical step is to get clarity on what kind of sleep problem you actually have. Is it circadian, hyperarousal, or mixed? Because the treatment follows the mechanism. A sleep diary for 2 weeks is free and tells you a lot. Note when you get into bed, when you actually feel sleepy, when you fall asleep, how many times you wake up, and how you feel in the morning. That pattern will point you in the right direction.
If the pattern shows a consistent delay, you're not sleepy until hours after your desired bedtime, bring that data to your doctor. The melatonin agonists are most effective for that specific phenotype. If the pattern shows you're tired but your brain won't shut off, that's more likely hyperarousal and CBT. I should be part of the conversation.
The other practical piece is to be realistic about the timeline. Circadian phase shifting takes weeks, not days. If you start a melatonin agonist or light therapy, commit to at least 3 weeks before evaluating whether it's working. A lot of people quit after 3 days because they don't feel different, but the circadian clock doesn't move that fast.
If you're using over-the-counter melatonin, check the actual dose. Look for products that have been third-party tested, USP verified or NSF certified, and consider starting with a much lower dose than what's on the label. You can break a 1 mg tablet in half. 500 micrograms is plenty for most people.
For the morning side of the equation, the takeoff problem, there are a few things that can help even without medication. One is to get bright light exposure within 30 minutes of waking. Even if you can't do a light box, stepping outside for 10 minutes of natural daylight helps suppress residual melatonin and signal to your clock that it's daytime. Two is to avoid hitting snooze. Sleep inertia is worse when you fragment your final hour of sleep with snooze cycles. Set one alarm and get up.
If the morning grogginess is severe and persistent, it's worth discussing with your doctor whether a delayed-release stimulant or even a low-dose immediate-release stimulant taken upon waking could help bridge that gap. The morning impairment in ADHD is real and can have significant functional consequences: missed work, missed appointments, strained relationships.
The last practical point I'd make is that coming off a sleep medication, which Daniel's doing right now, is its own thing. Rebound insomnia is common and it's temporary. It doesn't mean you're doomed to never sleep again. It means your receptors are recalibrating. Give it time.
If the rebound is severe, there are strategies to manage it. A temporary low dose of a melatonin agonist can ease the transition without creating a new dependence problem. The key is to have a plan with your doctor rather than white-knuckling it alone.
The thing I keep thinking about is how many people are in Daniel's position. They started a sleep medication for what was supposed to be a short-term thing, and now they're stuck. The pharmaceutical industry has not served these people well. The incentives have been all wrong. Develop a drug that works fast, feels potent, and creates enough dependence that people stay on it. The melatonin agonists are the opposite of that business model. They're subtle, they take time, and they don't create dependence. That's probably why they've been undermarketed.
That's a cynical take, but there's truth to it. The Z drugs generated tens of billions of dollars in revenue. Ramelteon, by comparison, was a commercial disappointment for Takeda. The market rewarded potency and rapid onset over mechanistic precision. But for the patient, mechanistic precision is what actually matters for long-term health.
That's what I hope people take from this conversation. The goal isn't to find the strongest thing that will knock you out. The goal is to find the thing that works with your biology rather than against it.
Which is really the broader principle that applies to so much of medicine. Work with the system, don't override it.
I think we've covered the ground Daniel was asking about. The melatonin receptor agonists represent a different approach to sleep medicine. Not sedation, but circadian resynchronization. Ramelteon and Tasimelteon are the two FDA-approved options, with Ramelteon being more for sleep onset and Tasimelteon being more for phase shifting. The orexin antagonists are a complementary approach for hyperarousal, and the future is likely to bring even more selective compounds that can fine-tune specific aspects of the sleep-wake cycle.
For someone with ADHD-related circadian disruption, the combination of targeted medication, timed light exposure, and realistic expectations about the pace of change is probably the most sustainable path forward.
Thanks to Hilbert Flumingtop for producing. This has been My Weird Prompts. You can find every episode at myweirdprompts.com. We'll be back with another one soon.
Take care of your clock, folks.
This episode was generated using Gemini Flash 3. Text-to-speech engine was Chatterbox.
Thanks for listening to our show. My weird prompts, where odd thoughts go. From sloth slow takes to facts on cue, we chase the strange and follow through. Some nights it's news, some nights it's lore. A thought you've never heard before. The host dig in, the host dig deep. The stranger the prompt, the less they sleep. From tiny questions, big ones too. From half-formed hunches to deja vu. If something odd is in your head, send it in, we'll chase the thread. My weird prompts, that's the close. From sloth, from man, from long-eared host. Until next time, stay curious, keep weird in mind.